history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. They're not hiding, but often their incredible stories remain hidden for decades or even forever. And we know there's power in the perspective we derive from taking a little time to listen. So we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so the rest of us never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we end up not only learning a lot, it's not just educational, it can be pretty entertaining and eye-opening. And often it's inspirational to understand what they went through and how they faced it. We end up seeing more clearly why that label of the greatest generation has endured. Every once in a while, we meet a veteran who is also a centenarian. And we all know intuitively that it's pretty rare to live to 100 or beyond. And I don't know about you, but I was kind of curious what percentage of the population actually makes it to that century mark. Think about that for a second. What would you guess? 1 out of 100? 1 out of 1,000? Nope, not even close to that many. Roughly 2 out of every 10,000 Americans makes it to 100. And 80% of those who do are female, so it's extremely unique to find an American man who reaches that milestone, but you're going to hear the story of one of them today. And before we get to that, there are a couple of others on my mind. Two other centenarians who are absolute American treasures passed away in this past week. And if you're hearing their names for the first time today, I hope you'll take a little time online and do a little research, learn about them. I have some links up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. In Colorado Springs on Tuesday, Jim Downing finished his race at the age of 104. Jim was one of the most spirited Pearl Harbor survivors you could ever meet. I recently read his book, The Other Side of Infamy, and I'd recommend that to anybody. It's linked for you online. In Colorado Springs, they even have a bridge over Interstate 25 named after him. Jim Downing will never be forgotten, and neither will Julio Barella. The ranks of Pearl Harbor survivors are dwindling, but we are left now with an even smaller number of survivors of the infamous Bataan Death March. If you ever find yourself in Las Cruces, New Mexico, you have to visit the Bataan Death March Memorial there, complete with footprints cast from actual survivors trailing a statue of two men helping another along that trail of misery. This coming Monday in Las Cruces, they'll be gathering to remember Julio Barella, who died last Monday at the age of 101 at the New Mexico Veterans Home in Truth or Consequences, the same place where I had the privilege of interviewing him 8 years ago. If you'd like to hear Mr. Barella's incredible story of survival, pull up episode number 114 at hometownheroesradio.com. Jim Downing and Julio Barella, two centenarians who inspired more people than they'd ever know. But today, we're going to look ahead to the 100th birthday of Robert Thacker, who's also been in the news lately. He turns 100 this coming Wednesday, February 21st. And you can't make it to that number without being resilient. But here's a taste of just how resilient he is. 2 months ago, on December 17th, Colonel Thacker was walking across a crosswalk near his home in San Clemente, California, when he was struck by an SUV. He ended up in the hospital with a broken foot, lacerations on both sides of his body, a laceration to the side of his head, and even slight bleeding on the brain. After all that, you might not expect your average 99-year-old to still be breathing 2 months later. But average has never been a word that applies to Robert Thacker. When I caught up to him on the phone this week, he said he wasn't feeling great, and he wasn't the same guy, but I sure heard the same vigor in his voice, the same humor, the same wit, and I'm going to let you hear for yourself, starting with the explanation. What's his secret to reaching the century mark? After all his close calls during World War II, including flying into Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, his work as a test pilot, and even this most recent odds-beating episode getting literally run over on the street. So as that commercial used to say, Colonel Thacker, how is it that you keep taking a licking but keep on ticking?
Well, number one, Paul, it's modern medicine that's making all of this possible. And good luck, not bad luck. Ever since my yo-yo champion of Southern California in 1932, I've been a lucky guy. I'm proud of a couple of things. Number one, I'm proud of my family. I'm proud of my good luck. And I got in on day one when the shooting started at Pearl Harbor. I lucked through that. I flew a complete tour in the Japanese area, and then I turned around and went to Europe, where the big war was really on, and I flew a complete tour against the German Empire. And the missions were, when I started flying in Europe, was about 20 missions, and you were either dead or shot down in B-17s. And I flew 33 missions. I led 33 missions and survived a return to the States. Now, I'm the only one that I can think of. I'm not saying I am now. I'm saying that I am aware of. There may flew in both theaters, but there's very few completed a complete tour in both theaters. So, Paul, that's the whole thing. But you know what people are interested in? When they meet me, they say, Colonel, are you the guy that won the Southern California Yo-Yo Champion in 1932? They're not interested in my missions or what happened. They want to pull my leg. They say, are you still active? And I say, no, I'm almost 100. So, Paul, that's it. I had a great time. I'm having a great time. And thank you for your interest.
I've got to follow up with a question on the Yo-Yo Championship of 1932. What was your winning trick? What'd you make the yo-yo do?
Do you know I got a $20 gold piece, a $10 gold piece, and a $5 gold piece as first prize? If I would have kept those instead of putting them in the bank, it would be worth $1,300 today. So you got to watch this spending program that we're not paying for today, gentlemen. That's all I have to say about the situation at the present time. However, Trump is our president, and we've got to support him. He's the only president we have.
I'm wondering what you're going to do to celebrate the century mark.
Well, I'm having about 120 people to come to my home. And I want these people to see my house. I want them to see my models and the model aircraft shop that I have in my garage. And I want it to be a home exercise. Well, my birthday, which is February 21st, 2018. Mm-hmm. So my soup is getting cold. So this is all of my talk that I'm going to give today.
Fair enough. Well, happy birthday, sir. I hope you have a special time, and I hope you're out there flying your model airplanes again soon.
I haven't flown for over half a year. No, Paul, I have to stabilize myself with a walker.
Yeah.
I have to have someone with me 24 hours a day. So I'm sort of in jail.
Man, that stinks.
It certainly does. But, you know, you can't turn back time and things that have happened. You just got to expect them as they come every hour.
Well, that's good advice for all of us, no matter where we are in life. And I'm sorry to make you reheat your soup there, but we'll look forward to some photos from that 100th birthday celebration. And we're going to celebrate Robert Thacker now by listening to the story he told us 5 years ago when he was just a tender 95-year-old. And as we cue that up, please keep Colonel Thacker in your prayers. He's not used to being confined to his home. You can hear how sharp he still is mentally. And knowing his story, I would not be surprised at all to see him back out there competing in radio-controlled airplane competitions as a centenarian. But we're going to go back now to his childhood, growing up in El Centro, California. And like every pilot, there was a moment where he caught the flying bug. For Robert Thacker, it happened when he was 9 years old.
There was a gentleman by the name of Lindbergh, and he was the first person out of many, many, many that made it from New York to Paris nonstop in the Spirit of St. Louis. And I'm only about 120 miles from San Diego, where the Spirit of St. Louis was made and constructed by Ryan Aircraft Company. and I was bitten. I said, that's what I'm going to do when I'm a little older. And that was in 1927, and Lindbergh was a true genius.
So just reading about it in the newspaper and hearing about him, you said, that's something that I want to do?
Yes, absolutely. I followed that along as quickly as I could. Went through El Centro High, El Centro Junior College, graduated from El Centro JC in 1937. Actually, all of a sudden, I kind of ran out of money and brains at the same time. So I thought I would enlist in the Air Force, in the Air Corps in those days. And I took my physical in 1937. There were 10 of us at March. There were 2 of us passed. One of them didn't look like an officer, so they failed him. And I was 1 out of 10 that started out passing the physical. Can you imagine such idiocy? You didn't look like an officer, so you're failed. But I only had 2 years of college, so I had to wait a couple of years before I was called for my pilot training. And I enlisted as a flying cadet in 1939, and I took off from there.
Do you remember a big thrill the first time you got up in the air? Is that something that's still fresh in your mind after all the flight hours you have since then?
Well, actually not, because I had been in the model business and flying model aircraft, and I knew most of the aerodynamics and most of the background, and I had a couple of flights before that with civilian aircraft, so I was not too much impressed with the situation initially. As you know, I have sort of a problem attitude towards situations. Actually, the big surprise I got when I got to primary was I saw all these airplanes snaking down the taxiway. And I thought, my God, I can taxi straighter than that. What's going on around here? Well, as a student, you're in the back seat and you're blind, so you have to snake along so you won't run into the guy in front of you. So I really wasn't so smart after all.
One of the questions I ask every veteran that I interview, regardless of what branch of service, regardless of what his duties were in the war, I ask them all about December 7th, 1941. I know you have a very interesting story about that, but I want to hear a little bit before that. What were you doing in the buildup to that day, and how were you where you were?
I'll tell you who you are. You're a second lieutenant, and you're stationed at Salt Lake City at Fort Douglas, which they ran the Indians out of. So you can imagine what status was when we were in Salt Lake City. This is, you're married about 8 or 9 months, and nothing yet. About December the 1st, my boss called me in and said, Thacker, I want you to go up to Seattle and pick up a 4-engine B-17 Flying Fortress. And I said, Captain, I've never even sat in the left seat of a B-17. And he said, Thacker, don't you understand orders in English? Go up and pick up a B-17 and fly it back to your base here. And here is your navigator. And I said to the navigator, what are you doing in a flying cadet uniform? And they said, they jerked me right out of navigation school, and I'm your navigator. So we went up to Seattle, we picked up a B-17, and we flew back to Salt Lake City. And this was the 4th of December, and we took off from Salt Lake, 6 of us, to shake the airplanes down and to get accustomed to our navigators. And this, we were a ferry crew, really. We had no guns. We were actually on secret orders, but we wanted to find out what the cruise control was, because the B-17E was a little changed from the other B-17s. So we took off Friday night, and we got snowed out of Salt Lake, and we landed at Tucson. Saturday morning, we got a call from General Marshall, the number one Army man. He said, get out of bed. We were downtown hotel out of Tucson. We landed at the commercial airport because there wasn't any Tucson in those days. Nevertheless, he said, get out of bed, get your airplane ready to go, and go to Hamilton Field, which is 20 miles north of San Francisco. And stop by Sacramento and pick up anything you want, and but we'll see you in Hamilton Field. So I picked up. We never went back home. We left cars, women, laundry. So I called Betty Jo in Salt Lake, and I said, honey, if you want to see me, I think you better drive over to Hamilton. So she and a friend drive over Donner Pass in snow, you know how high, and when she got to Hamilton, they wouldn't let her on the field, and she started to cry and wanted to see this officer of the day, and they finally let her on. So Saturday night, December 6th, we had dinner at the officer's mess, and the gentleman sitting right next to us at the table was General Arnold, our number one Air Force man. What was he doing at Hamilton Field? He was making damn sure that these airplanes took off that night for Honolulu. So I said, honey, if you want to know who's who around here, I'll be flashing my landing lights as I taxi out. Took off about 10 o'clock Friday, Saturday night, beautiful evening. Second navigational ride with my navigator in a flying cadet uniform.
So the navigator didn't have a ton of experience. Neither did Robert Thacker in the cockpit. But that was all about to change as night turned into day in the Pacific Ocean. We need to catch our first break, but when we come back, we'll hear what he found himself flying into on December 7th, 1941. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for more on Colonel Robert Thacker, who turns 100 years old this coming Wednesday. And we'll be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight.
Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free
because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting ready to celebrate birthday number 100 for Colonel Robert Thacker this week by listening to some of his memories from an amazing career in aviation. Colonel Thacker will celebrate that birthday Wednesday in San Clemente, California, where he is the Pied Piper of the radio-controlled model airplane community. In December 1941, he was a young bomber pilot who'd been ordered to fly a B-17 from California's Bay Area to Honolulu. So you took off about 10 o'clock on Saturday night, December 6th, having no idea, no indication of the chaos that was about to unfold.
Nice and smooth. We were about 10,000 all the way. And about an hour out, I started playing with some nav stuff we had. The radio station stayed on all night at Honolulu for us.
I'm just wondering, I'm putting two and two together here. You're about 23 years old. You've got a wife you just said goodbye to. You're flying a plane that you didn't have much time in with a crew that really had no experience, and you're in the night over nothing but ocean all night. Were you at all intimidated by any of that?
Well, we had been up all night for two nights, no sleep. You're young, and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting three-star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, Oh, there's Doris Duke's home. We're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these black, these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, oh, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian, and I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower, no answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, what do you know? Blah, blah, blah. No, I said, come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, the tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly like that, bang, 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 all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I chopped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were three zeros jumped me. They shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around. And I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line. And I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial airdrop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line, and if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
Whew. Well, I can't imagine the amount of things that go through your mind in a situation like that when you know that your friends are dying, you don't know what's going to happen to you. How did you respond to the chaos?
Everything went out of those barriers. Everything went out of those hangars. There were motorcycles. There were people. There were engines. Everything was on fire. They wiped out. They did a beautiful job with it. And 13 biddies, I think they were, at about 8,000. And they didn't miss. They really wiped out that flight line. And where are you going to go? What are you going to do? How can you help? How can you protect? First thing you do is protect your crew, which we left that out. And a little sort of side story. I took the crew down to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel on Wednesday for lunch. It was all free. The Japs were going to take the islands. There's no question about it. We had no foxholes. We had no nothing. It's an unbelievable story. And the Japanese did such a perfect operation. Mass, surprise, all of the great elements of war, and they did it beautifully. There's no question about that. They sank every boat in that harbor. There were 3 feet of bunker fuel on fire in Pearl Harbor. They sank every boat in the harbor. They sank the floating dock, and they sank the boat in the floating dock. quite an operation.
And I know as someone with the military background that you have, you can appreciate the success of their operation, but I'm sure emotionally for you, being an American, wearing that uniform and seeing that devastation had to have some kind of impact on you. What did it do to you in terms of your focus and desire to do anything?
You asked me where I grew up, and I said I grew up in the Air Force. That grew you up real quick. Real quick. But I think my attitude is just a little bit different because the military was going to be my career. I made a judgment at that time. And the military is like any other, it's like General Motors or any other big corporation. And it was my job. It was my job. And I was lucky to survive. I owe this lovely home to surviving 31 years in the Air Force. So my attitude is a little bit different than the great guys I was with, really, because most of them were draftees, actually, and I was a volunteer in 1937. So the situation is a little bit different.
How long did you stay there on Oahu before you started going elsewhere?
We started out doing 800-mile Y searches every fourth day. Then along in about February, we went on over to Australia and Port Moresby, New Guinea, and I flew 48 missions out of Port Moresby. Got a little few side stories of my tour in against the Japanese, and then I snuffled my way after a year over there where the big guns were, and that was in England, and I flew a tour in England, which is rather unique.
Yeah, to have flown particularly that number of bombing missions both in the Pacific and in Europe. And now, when you get to that high number of a bombing count, a lot of guys would have been back home already. Why were you out there so long? Is you wanted to be, or because they kept you there?
Well, I guess they kind of decided that after a year of operation that they would send our unit home, and I was sent home, and I started training crews, and I decided that training crews was not my deal, and I wanted to get ahead. And in the military, you go where the greatest noise is, and the greatest noise was in Europe because Germany was the number one guy and the Japanese was the number two. So I sniffled my way and flew a B-17 tour out of England, and it was the smartest decision I ever made.
Why was that?
Because I got myself promoted.
Yeah, that shows up in the pocketbook, too. Well, you said there are some side stories about all those missions out of Port Moresby. Entertain us with a couple if you have time. I'm sure you never got shot at or anything.
Oh, this is kind of a funny story on me. During the Battle of the Coral Sea, my B-17 had some radar antennas on it. We were just on a reconnaissance mission at about 20,000 feet. All of a sudden, my radar operator picked up a return only. That's the radar in those days was very primitive. And he said, "I've got an object up there about 40 miles out. Let's go take a look at it." This is the Coral Sea battle. So I cruised over there, took about a right turn, 5 degrees. And, well, we didn't know what was down there. But all of a sudden, I started getting anti-aircraft return. So I said, "Well, if they're shooting at me and I'm an American B-17, that must be one of the Japanese cruisers." So I told the bombardier to open the bombay door and we'll make a run on them. And I'm carrying 4 1,000-pound bombs. Any one of those bombs would have blown the cruiser in half. He set the bomb site up with intervalometer. You drop 1, 2, 3, 4. Damn. He put 2 short and 2 over. So when I got back to Moresby, 7 miles, I had a reception. I had a brigadier general and a full colonel. He said, "Lieutenant, you just missed the USS Chicago." In those days, the Navy didn't tell you anything. Here I am, the only reconnaissance airplane airborne in the South Pacific, and I didn't know where the USS Chicago was. I didn't know where any of the Navy was. But that sort of peaked up the little deal, and we got a little bit more information on what the Navy was doing. So, you know.
What did that feel like in that moment to be told that news?
Well, I was happy that we certainly didn't hurt anybody. And God, if we had hit the Chicago, that would have just been terrible. It would have ruined my career, really. It would have been awful. Of course, friendly fire is very common in the military. Very common.
That's a lot of missions, and I know there's a lot of stories, and maybe some of them run together. But give us a sense of what it was like to take those missions, what you would encounter along the way. What were some of the, besides that one, which is incredible, maybe the moments where you felt your crew might actually be in jeopardy?
Quickly, I'll just run through, say, a mission, B-17 bombers in the European theater working out of England. By that time, I was, in all honesty, I was probably the most experienced combat B-17 pilot in the business, period. And I always flew as a lead crew. You're leading the wing, or you're leading the division, or I even led the United States Air Force complete with 2,600 bombers running on Berlin, and you have authority to turn them around. You have authority to do anything. That's big authority. But you get up about midnight, you take special lead crew training, and you get off at first light, and there's a group of 54 B-17s every 2 minutes departing the UK. And that is a big, big thrill. The best mission I think I ever ran, and with the bombardier that I thought was absolutely superb. We ran on Peenemünde. Peenemünde is the Germans' big rocket development place. And my bombardier absolutely destroyed Peenemünde from 25,000 feet. That was a great ride. Just a tremendous, tremendous feeling to be part of that game, part of the profession that you've chosen for your life's work. And I've got some pictures of how my bombardier did that day.
Oh, I'd love to see those. And I'd also like to hear, I mean, I didn't hear you mention anywhere in there anything about flak, anything about enemy fighters, but I'm sure that's not because it didn't happen.
Oh, we had lots of flak and lots of enemy fighters, and you know who they were looking for, don't you? Well, what the German fighters were really looking for were people that lost an engine and thing like that and could not stay in formation. The German pilots were no better or no worse than the American fighter. They always, everybody wants to survive in this business. Survival is very, very necessary. Actually, we defeated everybody by the people at home that produced this massive wealth of offensive material. We're no better fighters than the Germans or the Japanese. We just out-manufactured them, that's all. How can the Japanese, with 70 million people, defeat a country in those years with 130 million people? Who's going to win the war? The guy with 130 million people.
Well, and you speak to the manufacturing, and I would think you have a good perspective on that, because you were in the Air Corps from 1937, when there were very few planes, very few resources, and then you saw it at its height at the end of the war. Can you put that into perspective for us, how great the contrast was from pre-war forces for America to at the end of World War II?
Well, I don't have much of a background, of course, for those kind of questions, but...
You saw it, right? You certainly saw the difference.
I was amazed at the motion pictures that we've been able to maintain by the Navy, of the masses of seagoing vessels, merchant marines. Many of the days, on my first tour in the Japanese Empire, I was the only airplane offensive for that day in the whole theater, because we had no aircraft. You're in Port Moresby, New Guinea, and there's nothing in Port Moresby, New Guinea that looks like a B-17. You have got to manufacture that in Seattle and get it over there with a knowledgeable crew, which is a tremendous, tremendous task. But we did it, and of course we won eventually. But for the first year of operation in the Pacific, the Aussies really thought they were going to be invaded.
And you had some situations where any reasonable analysis would tell us you were likely to be killed. We'll hear about some of that from Colonel Robert Thacker when we come back. He turns 100 this week. Keep him in your prayers and keep it here for the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and just a sliver of the remarkable aviation career of Robert Thacker of San Clemente, California. He'll celebrate his 100th birthday on Wednesday, February 21st, but it's not a stretch to say he was fortunate to make it to 25. In a few minutes, we'll hear about his post-World War II test pilot adventures that included a record-breaking flight in a P-82 twin Mustang named for his bride, Betty Jo. But first, some close calls as a B-17 pilot during World War II.
We operated really out of Port Moresby, 7 Mile, over the Owen Stanley Range, and the Japanese had a base called Lay, and this mission was to destroy or beat up Lay a little. I dropped my bombs, and we did hit the airfield for a change, and my bombardier said, I just saw four zeros take off while the bombs were going down, and in I think about 15 minutes those zeros were doing circles around me, and I had that old B-17 full bore, and the Japanese Zeros were shooting 20mm cannons at us. And the B-17, the best we had was 50 calibers and 130 caliber firing out the nose. Now, an airplane made to shoot you down and firing cannons at you, which is twice as big as your 50 caliber, and flying circles around you, who do you think is going to win?
I want to know how you got out of it, because there's no way that you should have won.
My waist gunner got a 20mm cannon shell in his, right on the top of his cranium, right here. Finally those zeros left me. We got shot up pretty bad, and I thought I was going to lose my waist gunner. But we went into Horn Island, which is northern Australia, and we finally got some fuel and got back into Townsville, Australia, where my gunner could get some help, and they cut a big chunk in his head and took out part of his skull and put a silver plate in, and he was just fine. But when you see those big white balls coming straight at you, you just want to take that armor and turn it right down over your face. And you're alone now. You're only alone. One airplane. And the airplane was full of holes, of course. But that's the only. I brought back a dead tail gunner once. But you expect those things, and that's what you're paid for.
No, I hear that, and I know how many missions you had. But I just have to wonder, when you're that age and you've developed these relationships with the guys on your crew, how that hits you when you see a guy missing a chunk of his head, or you see a guy that is not going to go home to his family. How did you deal with that at the time?
Well, actually, you just pressed on, that's all. It was a little bit more personal because I kept the same crew in the Pacific, and we were flying recce and bombs. We carried half fuel in one side of the airplane and bombs in the other side. And you do develop a certain camaraderie with your crew. But in England, all of my missions were lead crews, and I took and ran the pilot off of a good crew. So I never flew with the same crew, because you're the air commander. So it wasn't too personal in the UK, but it was very personal in the Pacific, because we lost a few crews. We lost a few crews.
Speaking of personal, how often did you hear from Betty Jo while you were out there flying all over the world?
I would get a letter, maybe a couple of letters a month, because right after Pearl Harbor, Betty Jo wrote me and said, the people are asking, where's the Navy? Where's our Navy? And I wrote back, the Navy is the bottom of Pearl Harbor. Well, I didn't find that out until after the war, and I got home, and Betty Jo said, all that was cut out of your letter, honey. Mail wasn't too frequently. But she was a beautiful letter writer, one of those people that could just write a beautiful, beautiful letter. And she was a beautiful, beautiful lady, of course. Great Air Force wife.
Well, I think by now everybody listening has gotten a sense of your personality. I get the impression that you weren't the kind of guy who was too worried about whether or not you were going to come home. It seems like maybe it never even entered your mind that you might not make it.
I can tell you right now, there was no question in my mind that they weren't going to get me.
And that's not just bravado. You really felt that then, it seems like.
Absolutely. Most people do. In fact, I don't know of anyone that in my military career, particularly during the difficulties, that thought they weren't going to make it. Most of my people were forward-looking troops as far as I was concerned. And certainly they weren't going to get me, period.
Here you had been there the day the war started for America. You had seen firsthand in very shocking fashion what had happened that day. To reach the end of the war and to realize that both of these enemies had been defeated, was that satisfying for you? What did you take from that?
I was just thankful that I could just sit down and there was no more killing going on. I just had this tremendous, tremendous relief of satisfaction that no more killings, and we can live in peace, at least for a few years. I didn't have a drink. I mean, I was with my sweetheart, and I had just been assigned to the flight test division at Wright Field, which is a plum position, because I knew we were having all of this new equipment coming off the line that had to be tested, and I was going to be a part of the flight test division at Material Command. And then I took off from there. But it was the relief of the attention that I felt. I didn't get out on the streets. I didn't do anything. I just sat down.
And I know this sounds crazy for a guy who flew so many missions in the war where there was flak coming at you and enemy fighters trying to shoot you down, circling around you like sharks in the water. But I think some people might say it takes even more guts and chutzpah to be a test pilot than it does to fly in a war. How did your wife feel about the fact that you were going to be a test pilot?
Well, I'll tell you a little side story, which you seem to think is the best part of the interview. Chuck Yeager and I were in the same test pilot school there at the academy at Wright Field. And after we got out of that, it was our first operational jet fighter, the P-80 Lockheed Shooting Star. Milo Burcham, their chief test pilot, had been killed. And Dick Bong had also been killed in the airplane. And my boss called me in and said, Thacker, I want you to take Chuck Yeager and two other pilots, go out to Lockheed and pick up 5 P-80s. It just killed our top ace, and then the chief test pilot had been killed in the damn thing. And I want you to fly 500 hours with no accidents. So we went up to Lockheed, went out on the dry lakes. In those days, the dry lakes, and that was all there was. It was tough living conditions. So we flew the 500 hours, and I briefed my people. I said, I want you to fly safely and always stay within glide distance if you flame out of one of the dry lakes. And the second day we were flying, who do you think I caught reporting to San Francisco Air Traffic Control? Yeager. But nevertheless, the problem with the P-80 is, in those days, they had a fuel pump that was failing them. So they put an emergency fuel pump on them, and you used it for takeoff. Even in those days, you have to use a checklist. Dick Bong did not turned his emergency fuel pump on for takeoff. The main fuel pump failed. Unfortunately, Dick landed in a rock quarry. But when my boss called me in, he said, "You're next." So, you know.
I don't think I'd feel very good about my prospects if Dick Bong, the leading P-38 ace in the Pacific and their top test pilot.
Dick was a great guy, and he was a go-getter. 40% of all the shoot-downs in World War II by fighter people was performed by only 6% of the pilots. For other words, to be a... Well, Chuck Yeager got 13, so Chuck is no slouch. Not every fighter pilot is a hero, is what I'm trying to explain. Or a bomber pilot either. But to be a high-scoring ace, you are exceptional. My hat is off to him.
Well, and they sure took on a lot of risk in getting all those kills.
That's what I say. I mean, you did not have to expose yourself as a fighter pilot. The high-scoring aces went after them and did the job, and my hat is off to them.
Getting back to the P-80s, so they say, oh, these two guys are dead, you're next. I mean, I don't think that makes you feel very good about your chances here.
No, but you're men, and that's the business you're in, and that's what you chose to do, and go do the job. Really, in those days, you did what you were told. Today, you get a lot of back talk, I guess. People ask me, how come this Betty Jo thing that you flew from Honolulu to New York, how did that happen? And I said, I was told to do it.
Wasn't your idea.
It wasn't my idea. In fact, I assigned a first lieutenant and a captain to the job. I had a lot of time in it in right field doing some experimental work with it.
Let's tell everybody what this is and then finish your story. So most people, they've heard on this program about just about every plane that America flew during World War II. I don't think any of them have ever heard of a P-82. I guess what, you take two P-51s times by two and then subtract 20? Is that how you get 82?
Yeah, well, something like that. However... the P-82 Twin Mustang is the same profile as a single fuselage a P-51, but actually it was a completely different airplane, much larger in all aspects, and it was a very good airplane. The reason that nobody wanted any part of it and the job was put off to me was it was prop-driven. And everybody wanted to fly the P-80, the jet. So my job was not in the fighter section. My job was accelerated service, and I've been doing most of the work with the Twin Mustang. My boss called me in and said, no, Thacker, you do this. So they wanted me to fly from Tokyo to New York, and I said, I don't think so. It might go from Hawaii to... New York nonstop, which it did, but I had to wait 3 weeks for a 20 knot tailwind. So I had to wait for a little bit of help, but we got to New York with enough fuel to my alternate, which was Boston, which was 63 gallons. So that was a good flight. It just happened to make the flight for a no news day. So I was the news for that day. So we made every front page in the country. Hawaii to New York nonstop with a fighter, 14 and a half hours. This was in February 1947.
Yeah, it must have been a slow news day in 1927, too, when Lindbergh went across the Atlantic. Did that mean something to you, having grown up idolizing Lindbergh, that here you had a feat that in some ways was a lot like what he did?
No, you're much too kind to me. Much too kind. No, Lindbergh. Lindbergh was really a genius. The Spirit of St. Louis had a fuel tank right in front of it for weight and balance problems. And he had a periscope that he looked out the side of the airplane to land it and take off. So this sort of stuff, and he was also alone, was not carrying a lot of excess baggage. So Lindbergh was one of my idols. He's, as a politician, not so good. But as an aviation enthusiast, he was a genius.
So when you made it to New York, and as you describe, a slow news day, I don't think anyone else would put it that way, but you get all this attention, it's in the papers. How special was it for you to be able to tell the story of how that plane got its name?
I was amazed at the you know, you just do what you're supposed to do, and that's the end of that. But they wanted to know what North American, Los Angeles area, who built the airplane. And I said, Betty Jo. I've always wanted them, because I never really had an airplane, because I was always in the lead later on in my career. And so they put Betty Jo on the side, and there we are. And she waited in New York for me for 3 weeks. And kind of a cute story. One of the managers of big hotels in New York said, where's Betty Jo staying in New York? I was waiting for a tailwind in Hawaii. And so he called Betty Jo and said, you come and blah, 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 stay at my hotel. So she went over, and they put her in the honeymoon suite on the top. And she went down the next morning and said, I'm just a lieutenant colonel's wife, and I can't afford this kind of accommodations. And the clerk said, Mrs. Thacker, you are guest of the hotel for the remaining time. So she had a marvelous 3 weeks in Hawaii, in New York City, as guest of the Hamilton Hotel. So that's kind of a cute story. I can't afford this. I'm only a lieutenant colonel's wife. And she couldn't, of course.
That's great. And that, besides being on a beautiful blanket that adorns your couch here in your home in San Clemente.
I signed some autographs for a friend a couple of years ago. And here came this beautiful hanging of the Betty Jo. And I said, honey, what are we going to do with this thing? So I just put it there on our divan, which I didn't think she'd allow it in the living room. Because you don't see the airplanes around, do you? And she liked it, so I just leave it there.
Well, it's got her name on it. How could she argue? And that plane, the twin Mustang P-82, is in the Air Force Museum in Ohio. What does that mean to you to be able to go there if you wish, or to have other people stop by there and look at something that was a part of history and your history?
Well, it's kind of fun to have people come up, and they're so nice to me. And they say, we were Dayton, Ohio the other day, and we saw the Betty Jo in the museum, and it was just great fun. And that makes you feel good. You can't help it, you know. And the Betty Jo will be there forever.
And from there, you went into the jets, as you talked about. Can you give us a sense for what that was like for you to go from propeller-driven planes your whole life to flying these things with really unbridled power? How that felt and how you experienced that?
Well, actually, I've got two Rolls engines.
You mean in the P-82?
P-82. And in the P-80, the first operational jet fighter only had about 2,300 pounds of thrust. The P-82 that I was flying would really, with Rolls engines, would run away from a P-80, because the Whittle engine that we had in the first operational jets was very low powered. Turbine thrust and reaction is much different than a prop. When you push the throttle on a prop, it goes. With a turbine engine, it takes a little few seconds to get this thing going. So you had to watch what you were doing, and our accident rate initially with the P-80 was terrible, because they were being flown by ex-hot dog aces, and they were violating the aircraft. The P-80, when it first came out, accident rate was 10 times the normal accident rate, and it was nothing but violating the weapon system.
So you were one of the people that flew it right and helped show the way for all the pilots that we have today flying F-15s. And I know you're saying, well, 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 but don't you feel like that you did something for all those pilots we have out there today flying jets, that the work you did had some value for what they're experiencing now?
Yes, I'm receiving the pleasures of your company and your attention. And so, of course, that makes me pleasant, makes me feel good. Let's face it.
Without you and those other pilots doing that, I mean, if people had said, you know what, this is too dangerous, we're not going to, you know, it's killing our best pilots, we're not going to keep up with this, then we wouldn't have what we had today. So what you guys did, the courage you showed and the persistence, don't you think has paid off in a pretty big way?
Oh, yes, of course, but that's what we're supposed to do. That's what we're paid for. And it was very exciting. I just had a ball in the Air Force. Flying has been my interest, and it still is my interest. And that just makes life so pleasant.
And we wish a pleasant and exhilarating 100th birthday to the one and only Colonel Robert Thacker. When he first shared his story on Hometown Heroes in 2013, he had just paid for his own 95th birthday party. He told the gathered guests there that day that if he made it to 100, they were paying for the party, so I trust that'll be the case on Wednesday. You can learn more about Colonel Thacker online at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.